case is Hicks versus Midwest Transit. Theo?
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is John Tile, and I represent Hal Hicks in this appeal. The issue in this appeal is whether Midwest Transit is entitled to summary judgment based on claim preclusion and res judicata based on a decision in a state court. The standard of review on all summary judgments in this court is obviously de novo. First, I'd like to address the underlying judgment. The underlying judgment was a case in several sections. The first part of the case was a bench trial regarding issues related to the Business Corporation Act. And opposing counsel, even though initially requesting a jury trial, and the defendant, my client, requesting a jury trial in that case at the end of at the beginning of the first trial, moved to strike the jury trial based on the issues under the Business Corporation Act and the statutes thereunder. And the court, finding that there would be issues that should be in front of the jury, took the plaintiffs and the receiver's argument and granted that, and in essence said we're going to have a bench trial on the non-jury issues. And in doing that, he severed all of the jury issues, which in that case we had filed several claims that were similar in this case. This case had concurrent jurisdiction over the breach of contract or breach of promissory note and the breach of the credit line. This particular case is regarding a counterclaim that Hicks filed against Midwest Transit in the underlying suit. I believe it was initially an interpleader action filed by Midwest Transit, and then Hal Hicks counterclaimed.
You know, you have to, it's somewhat complicated, at least I'm finding it to be, but it looks to me like the severance of these issues was more to sever Hicks's claims against Midwest from Hicks's claims against others, not to separate some of Hicks's claims against Midwest from other claims that it had against Midwest. Got to help me on that.
Sure. Unfortunately, for the appellees, that there's nothing in the record that would indicate that. And if you look at the judgment, the final judgment in the bench trial, there is no specific ruling on the two claims that were filed by Mr. Hicks for these promissory notes. And he was well aware.
But they were discussed. Was discussion about them.
A brief discussion, but then that tied into the severance, and then you move into the bench trial, and the result of the bench trial and all the issues and evidence presented at the bench trial are the evidence in this case supporting or arguing against whether res judicata applies.
But on the other hand, also, there's nothing by Hicks saying now, everybody is to understand here that we have these jury issues that are outside the scope of this bench trial, and we are preserving our rights to have those issues heard in some other forum or by jury in this particular forum that you were in.
Well, the response that Mr. Hicks made in the summary judgment that they filed to separate certain counts in the bench trial and what was to be heard under the bench trial in that hearing, obviously, when the court addressed what was to be tried, he indicated that what was to be tried were the issues underneath the Business Corporation Act. And obviously the Business Corporation Act deals with nothing related to a claim that a shareholder has based on loans that were signed off by the corporation and were secured by corporate property, et cetera. And in addition, the reason that I assume that the judge did that was because he wanted to preserve his right to protect his severance and to isolate the bench trial, because if he would have tried issues that were under common law, like contracts, in this case promissory notes, if he would have lost that on appeal because he would have combined jury trial right issues with Business Corporation Act issues, which he believed under the statute there was no right to a jury trial.
What should we make of the language in the final judgment that states that judgment was in favor of Midwest and on several claims made by Mr. Hicks, including, and I'm going to quote, all claims by Hal D. Hicks against Midwest for monies lost by Hal D. Hicks, 2020. In other words, how can that be anything?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is Mr. Hicks obviously has the right, if, and there's no evidence in the record to support that these issues even came up, but to answer the question, Mr. Hicks there would have to be more findings of fact and conclusions of law regarding rulings on a breach of promissory note and a breach of a line of credit. There's absolutely no language in the order or in the trial transcript, which was 8 weeks of trial and some 81 days of trial. There's no evidence with regard to when the note was paid on. Or in, if they want to argue it was paid off, there's one of the key elements in this type of claim is the final judgment would have to include a satisfaction of judgment or satisfaction of the debt. And that never happened because there was never any argument in the court because it was clear that there were no jury trials to be argued. And if you look more closely at the judgment, you will find that he specifically references certain counterclaims that were filed by Mr. Hicks, and the breach of these promissory notes were not specifically identified in the judgment itself, wherein the other claims, they clearly identified, the counts and the numbers, et cetera. My time is running, so I'll preserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Tile. Sharp.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Terry Sharp. I represent the receiver of Midwest Transit, Inc. These litigants have been before your honors in this case once before, and we were here several months ago in case 05-4523. The base litigation started as a shareholder's derivative suit, and after about a year and a half of hearings before there was a receiver, the trial judge found uncontradicted evidence of self-dealing and fraud. Don Hoagland, my client, was appointed receiver on July 25th of 01. That decision was one of the first, I think the first one that was appealed. There have been dozens, almost dozens of appeals since then. Went to the 5th District Appellate Court, and they affirmed the appointing of the receiver, noting it would have been abuse of discretion not to have done so, rather stern statement. However, in the meantime, 5 days after my client was appointed receiver, another attorney filed the instant lawsuit. That was the case that came before this court before, and after remand, the counterclaim was allowed to stand, and that case is before the court. While all this was going on, the base shareholder's derivative suit of Witters versus Hicks went forward. And counsel was right. We had a very long trial. And it was a Business Corporation Act case involving Section 8.60. And everybody in that courtroom, and the record clearly shows, it was an accounting action under the 8.60 concerning Hicks's fraudulent conduct, self-dealing, and plain theft. And that case resulted in a $22 million judgment in favor of my client against Hal Hicks. Incidentally, the plaintiff, the original plaintiff, the other shareholder, got a $500,000 punitive damage award because of some of the things that happened. During the course of that trial, we learned about a 2020 account. Now, that's an accounting software number that was put on an account, has no particular significance in itself. It could have and probably should have been called cash transfers to and from Hal Hicks, because it's undisputed that he transferred lots of money out of the company, into the company, back and forth. On the day my client was appointed receiver, the books and records of the company said that Hal Hicks was owed over $6 million. That was the largest single number on the balance sheet of Midwest Transit. Hal Hicks came before the court and is before this court with a note and a mortgage that says, I put this much money in on June 12, 1998. And my client doesn't dispute that. The evidence that was before the trial court, Your Honors, was that he had paid in not only that amount of money, but large millions, literally millions of additional dollars. But the evidence, unfortunately, was that he had taken out more than he had put in. And we were able to trace through the records with professional witnesses to show the canceled checks, the wire transfers to Hal Hicks, to Hal Hicks's related corporations, and to trusts that were set up for his family. And at the end of the day, it was found that he'd taken out more than he put in. Judge Hill found, as it relates to these particular claims, that Hal Hicks had not sustained a sufficient burden of proving to a preponderance of the evidence credits to the 2020 account. And he, in fact, entered judgment on this 2020 account, as Your Honor cited from that record, a judgment in favor of my client for $565,000 on the 2020 account alone, and that amount is subsumed within the $22 million judgment that my client got. Well, obviously, armed with this, we moved for summary judgment in the federal court, and that's how we arrived here. Judge Gilbert quoted from portions of the record to sustain the fact and show that this note that is before this court and was before Judge Gilbert was, in fact, before the Lawrence County Court. Counsel is correct. There wasn't a lot of testimony particularly about the note. We went back into the beginning of the account and traced every debit and every credit through because we were dealing with an accounting fraud case. In the record on the motion for summary judgment was this question and answer from Hal Hicks's lawyer to Hal Hicks. Question: so as of June 12, 1998, Midwest Transit owed you $2.5 million. Answer: that is correct. That $2.5 million obligation is the very obligations before Your Honors. And I would submit that the very genesis of the 2020 account has already been litigated, and it is the note that we've had dismissed. Hicks's reply brief shows the foundation flaws of his argument. At page 5, and it was repeated in oral argument, if there was full adjudication of the note and line of credit, there would certainly be many more pages of testimony regarding the terms of the note and line of credit. And at page 6 of the reply brief, furthermore, there was no finding on interest, penalties, liquidated damage, and or attorney's fees. Judge Gilbert noted Hicks bore the burden of persuasion on these matters. And if he did not like the court's decision, that's Judge Gilbert's decision, or excuse me, the trial judge's decision, he should appeal, which he has. Judge Gilbert continuing, if he's not satisfied, this court, meaning the federal district court, is not the proper venue for satisfaction.
But what's the status of that appeal to the Illinois Court of Appeals?
We argued the appeal of this, of the mother case, as it's called, in Mount Vernon at the 5th District 3 or 4 months ago, just before we were up here on another matter. This is the third appellate decision in about, appellate argument in about 4.5 months now, and that case is under advisement in the 5th District.
Still under advisement.
Yes, sir.
When
now,
was it submitted in final form?
I think the court took that in early November. We had oral argument there in Mount Vernon.
In its reply brief, in his reply brief, Mr. Hicks, to argue that the Florida litigation was not... Is that true? Did your brief Florida litigation to the district court?
We attempted to, Your Honor. And what has happened, not only do we have the trial in Lawrenceville, we've had this claim in the federal district court. In the meantime, he tried to foreclose the mortgage in Florida. And as I stand here today, I can't exactly tell you how that all came before the court. We have tried to bring it up, and that case is also under advisement in the – it has been argued and is under advisement in the Florida appellate court. If I may –
Well, but is it possible to give a yes or no – it may not be possible to give a yes or no answer. Was the Florida litigation part of the record before the district court?
I think the answer to that is no, Your Honor, but I'm not positive as I stand here. I'm sorry.
So then they're correct when they wasn't based on Florida litigation.
I think that is the correct statement, Your Honor. It all has moved on three tracks simultaneously. It's very difficult to keep in mind. I believe this claim lacks merit. I don't believe there's a dispute as to a material fact in this litigation. There's no doubt, and I'm not here to deny, that Hal Hicks still has in his possession a note, and there is a recorded mortgage in Florida that says he, in effect, made the initial deposit in an account. We have had a trial, and the trial judge has found that not only did he do that, presumably, but he overdrew the account by some $565,000. My children use the phrase, been there, done that. In my submit to this court, Hal Hicks has been to court on this very claim. He tried to prove it, and he lost. Your Honors have a decision called the Garcia case, which simply says that res judicata refers to the preclusive effect of a judgment in foreclosing litigation in matters that were or could have been raised in an earlier suit. This is a woulda, coulda, shoulda thing. We've already done that. It was done in Lawrence County. It is a final judgment in the sense that there was no appeal posted, and we would ask the court to sustain the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp. Kyle, you have 2 minutes.
Your Honors, in response, again, opposing counsel stands before this court with minimal evidence to suggest that we had a full and final adjudication of a promissory note, a line of credit, a mortgage that's still on file in Florida, the terms of the note, the terms of the promissory note, the interest, when the interest was paid off, how much, if any, interest is due. All of the things that are part and parcel of a lawsuit for the adjudication of a promissory note and a line of credit. Now, even furthermore, he talks about Mr. Hicks claiming that he was owed $6 million. The receiver testified for 3 years, which is a part of this record, that he was owed $6 million, and this was based upon his own accountant's review of the records. Based on the review of those records and the admissions of the receiver, the trial court in 2002 took judicial notice that Mr. Hicks was owed $5.9 million. That issue was basically set aside. There's no response that they make to that because it's true. Furthermore, now they want to introduce an affidavit from their accountant, which is another admission that there's genuine issues of material fact. 2 years after the judgment in the Lawrence County case, they file a tax return for 2005 that states and is certified by the accountants, submitted to the IRS, Mr. Hicks was the only shareholder that loaned money, still owes $6.1 million. It can't be adjudicated if they're not even claiming to the IRS that the money's not been deducted. If it was taken out of the judgment, why would they report it to the IRS? In closing, my time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and we move to